not going to deal with item number one because it's major, all those departments. The same thing would happen to item number two. We'll be getting from that the status of the report. If DTI says they've never been involved, what is the status of the report? So the only item that we'll deal with is the briefing on the measures to address the significant decline in agricultural production and the subsequent negative impact on the employment and gross domestic product growth. So that will be the only item that we deal with. But if there is any explanation on the, particularly on the poultry, on the status of the report, we will then allow it to be presented. But item number one is obvious, we won't deal with it because it's led by the deputy president and they are not here.
Thank you, Chair. Just to let the Chair be aware that there are two presentations prepared on listeriosis and on the response to recommendations of the food security, which are touching, because the department is part of that exercise. And Dr. Maja was also going to talk to item two, progress report by the interdepartmental task team to address challenges facing the poultry industry.
No. Probably I heard you heard what I said. If the department is complaining that they were not involved, so there is no easy way that will undermine that, because means that the report in question, the status is questionable. If the said department, which was supposed to be part, were not part of that, so but the Department of Health, I'm told, is here for los services. Are they here? So let's start with item number three. If Department of Health on Los Teresos comes, and then we'll then go back to the Los Teresos issues and leave other matters that other department. Let's start with item number three. Where is the... they are late. You are saying they don't know Parliament, they get lost. You know, this is some of us excuses. They are not acceptable. You cannot say they are get lost, they get lost. They can't get lost in the Parliament. Because you enter the visitor center, they take you. If you don't know where you're going, they take you where you're supposed to go. So, that the apology. And you are leading this delegation. You start by lying to us, Joe. It's not right. So, in the meantime, then we'll then get a briefing on the services, Dr. Maja and the team.
Chairperson, you should first be able to pronounce the disease properly. Listeriosis.
Good morning.
I'm only trying to help you.
Yeah, no, that's good of you. Listeriosis. Can you then come back to order? We've heard you, Honorable Paulson, and we appreciate your correction.
Good morning, Honorable Members of Parliament. My name is Mphani Molefe. I am the director responsible for veterinary public health in DAF and a member of the incident management team that handled the listeriosis outbreak. So the presentation that I'm going to present here is a presentation that was supposed to be given by the National Institute for Communicable Disease. Unfortunately, they could not make it here, but they have sanctioned that I do the presentation on behalf of the whole team, which consists of the DTI, DAF, and the Department of Health. So I'll just go through it as was prepared. The first slide shows the membership of the team that handled the listeriosis, and as members can see, honorable members can see, it was led by the National Institute for Communicable Diseases and the National Health Laboratory Services. There was the National Department of Health that had various units there, including environmental health, food safety, communicable disease cluster, and within DAF, the primary group that was involved there was veterinary public health, and the DTI also was involved there through the National Consumer Commission and the NRCS, or National Regulator for Compulsory Specification, and they are present with us here today. And the provinces were also involved in various units, including provincial departments of health, provincial departments of agriculture. They were also involved, metropolitans, municipalities were involved, especially Tshwane, Ekurhuleni, and the city of Joburg. And we also got assistance from the World Health Organization, Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network. And the U.S. also assisted us. The Center for Disease Control was also involved in getting rid of the outbreak. This slide is just showing how we dealt with the outbreak, you know, in general. What were the areas of concern that we had to deal with when we met as the IMT or the incident management team, with the aim, you know, in the middle there to control and end the outbreak and strengthen systems to prevent future outbreaks. And if we start at the top there, you can see that it's about multi-sector coordination, and the critical component that then follows is surveillance, because you have to know what you have on the ground. So there was surveillance that was done, and then to go with surveillance, there has to be laboratory capacity, because all those samples have to be tested. So we had to develop laboratory capacity to deal with the outbreak. And also the monitoring aspect, you know, had to be strengthened. Legislation review, and as honorable members know, we've had an issue with our legislation, different legislations and the fragmentation of legislation. So that was one aspect that we had to then look into to make sure that the approach that we are taking will get us the outcome that is desired. And also the important part was stakeholder engagement. Communication had to be central. There was communication from different aspects, different units, but then all this communication that went out was coordinated so that, you know, all units of this team are saying the same message. Now here, this graph, this structure shows how then the team was set up. And as I said, it was led by the NICD that had an incident manager, but then there was also somebody from the WHO who was a co-manager of this team. And you had the NICD being the management or the admin portion of this team, and communication was also then critical, which was led by the department, the National Department of Health, but each department had somebody from its communication unit being part of the communication team. And this other area, blocks here just show the different aspects that I have already detailed previously in a previous slide. But there had to be partner coordination, there had to be information and planning, and the red part then shows who led, you know, those particular aspects and who were the membership of those areas. You also had health operations and technical expertise. You had operation support and logistics, and you also had to have finance and administration, because it's critical that we had to have somebody funding this. And the latest report that I got from the Department of Health is that it cost about $8 million to deal with the outbreak. So this is how this was structured, and this is also guided by the international health regulations. As South Africa is a member of the WHO, it also conforms to the international health regulations, and this is the basis on how you then deal with foodborne illnesses or outbreaks. This slide then shows how we then went through the process, starting on the 9th of April with phase one. But prior to the 9th of April, we were working, but not under an incident management team. There were a lot of activities that were done. When we started the incident management team, that's when this outbreak was then elevated to stage two out of three. That means it then needed more intervention, and this team was then set up. That's when the WHO then came on board to assist us. Now, these activities, that's what happened. You can see that there was stakeholder communication all the way from the 9th of April until we concluded on the 31st of August. This was a three-month project that WHO was involved in. There was information dissemination. Legislation review is also then ongoing as we are talking. There was engagement with Tiger Brands and RCL because they were identified as a source of the outbreak. Risk assessment was done, risk communication, prevention and control. PNC stands for prevention and control. That was done. There was a multi-sectoral team that went out to investigate these outbreaks, and there were recalls that were done of all those affected products. And information sequencing was also then done. The NHL Food Lab also then worked on its capacity building, you know, as well. So you'll note that at different aspects, you know, there were different activities taking place until at the end of August this year. Now, the graph here then shows where we were in 2017 and where we are now. When we started then identifying that there is an outbreak, you can see that the graph goes up, you know, from 1 week, epidemiological week one, and then it peaked, you know, very high at around week 48. And this is where then we were then identifying and doing a lot of testing and a lot of surveillance. And then after a lot of measures were put into place, including recalls, including the media alerts that the Minister of Health then put out, then we started seeing the amount of infections going down, the number of infections going down, until at the point where we ended up with a pre-outbreak level. Then that's when we then decided that the outbreak was over. The next slide then shows over a period of years. The previous slide was just on that when we identified the outbreak. But then as you can see, since 2013, listeriosis had always been there. And that is something that I think we need to clarify, that listeriosis had always been there, but at a what we can call acceptable level. Now, what happened last year, it now suddenly spiked to beyond, you know, what we had been accepting, and this is where then it was then declared as an outbreak. Now, if you can see, in 2013 until about the first part of 2017, or actually 2016, we had a little bit of incidents here and there, but then in 2017, then it spiked. And now where we are now, at the end of that graph, you'll see is the same as with the pre-outbreak levels, and that's why we can then say that the outbreak is over. Now, in terms of surveillance, the work that was done is, first of all, listeriosis was declared a notifiable disease under the National Department of Health, and therefore that meant that cases had to be reported. And as a result, then statistics will be kept and surveillance will then be improved. Unlike if it's not declared, that nobody is then obliged to then report it when they have a suspicious case. They don't necessarily need to follow it up and find out what is wrong. If a person comes with diarrhea, they can just treat it as diarrhea. But if it's declared as a notifiable disease, it means then there's a protocol that they have to follow to determine whether it's listeriosis, and if it's so, then they have to take additional measures. And the NICD had also implemented a system to detect outbreaks early. All isolates or all those samples that tested positive then are then subjected to something that is called whole genome sequencing. And whole genome sequencing then is a detailed analytical method that then determines, can even tell you between two different listeriosis cases that they are not from the same outbreak source, because you may find listeriosis, as we know, there's listeriosis that was reported in Australia on melons. Now, whole genome sequences will then determine that that is not the same as the one that we had in South Africa. So that is definite way to tell that these two cases are related. You know, so that's whole genome sequencing. And all cases, the NICD and the Department of Health are then doing a lot of interviewing of anybody with suspect case. They visit their families and they do interventions there. And all clusters of cases will be investigated early, as one of the lessons that we learned is that we need to be taking early measures in terms of dealing with this. And this approach has always been used in the U.S. and France with successful results. Now, in terms of strengthening the laboratory capacity that I talked about earlier, the NHLS Infection Control Laboratory has developed a strategy to streamline and focus environmental testing in districts. And we have also identified what we have termed, what we call at-risk facilities that are now going to be monitored much more frequently than it has been the case previously. And the new test methods are being developed and being validated to accurately identify Listeria monocytogenes. Earlier talked about whole genome sequencing, so that is part of that activity that is now being put in place. Unfortunately, the cost of running that whole WGS, whole genome sequencing, is restrictive. And as a result, you cannot then run a lot of samples. We only have two machines in the country, one at NIHLS and one at ARC, that we are trying to bring on board to make sure that in future we have enough laboratory capacity to make sure that we can even detect this outbreak early before it spreads. Over 2,000 samples have already been tested to an extent that we can then determine that we have a pre-outbreak level. So we did a lot of whole genome sequencing testing, but this 2,000 is only on WGS. It's not just on preliminary or primary testing that was done. Monitoring is also an aspect that is critical here. Now, there was a team that had NDOH, or National Department of Health Environmental Health Unit, South African Military Health Services was there as well, DAF was there, National Regulator for Compulsory Specification was there, and the one group that is missing, the NCC, National Consumer Commission, was also part of this monitoring. And training material were developed. And out of that, 900 environmental health practitioners and veterinary public health officials in food safety were trained in terms of going into an establishment, doing inspection, collecting samples, making sure that those samples are handled properly and send them to a laboratory, and when you get results, then how do you then interpret the results? So that training was done. But it's ongoing training. So this 900 was when we were dealing with the listeriosis outbreak. But now the commitment is that this, every new person who comes on board will then also be put through the training. At-risk facilities, or all facilities that produce ready-to-eat processed meat have been visited, have been inspected. Honorable members may note that listeriosis is a problem in ready-to-eat products and not necessarily in raw meat, because raw meat that is still going to be subjected to heat treatment, we don't necessarily put the same level of measures as we do in ready-to-eat products, because then there's no further treatment there, and if you eat it, you will take in all the material that is there. So this is, so the primary focus at this point was on processed products facilities, and those were visited and inspected. And then we categorized those. There were some that were good and some that were poor, and we categorized them at the risk, or those that we can then not necessarily categorize as at risk. And then from the DAF side, we then monitored imported products. And honorable members may remember that there was at some point an issue that was raised that are we testing imported products, and especially mechanically deboned meat from Brazil and other countries, and we can confirm that we were testing that for listeriosis, and we did not get any positive coming that links that material to the outbreak. So that was done, you know, through the DAF systems. Now, in terms of the two facilities or companies with three facilities that are involved, first of all, Tiger Brands or Enterprise. The Polokwane facility was visited in April by a team that had all members, as I described earlier. And at the moment, there's revamping of the factory. Right now, it's still closed. They've taken it apart. They've looked at the drains. They looked at the fence, at ventilation. They've taken it apart, and they are rebuilding it according to the recommendations that were made by the incident management team to make sure that we don't get a recurrence of the disease. And then when they are ready, then they will call us, and then the district municipality, in this case the Capricorn municipality, will then resample. And once we have negative results, that's when we can then allow them to continue operating the facility. Which is the same with Germiston. The Germiston facility of Tiger Brands was also inspected in April, and also revamping was done. You can see that we took about 178 swabs on the 24th of August, and those tested a negative. Now, this facility has been reopened. The Germiston facility has been reopened. And this week, actually I think yesterday, the team went back to do further sampling there. But at this point, Germiston is not yet exporting. It's only for local consumption. But now there's rigorous testing by the municipality at that premises. In terms of Rainbow Chicken Limited in Wolvehoek, it was closed, or a prohibition notice was issued under the Foodstuffs, Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act on the 5th of March in 2018 by the Fezile Darby Municipality. And they also then did extensive improvements, and there was a lot of engagement, you know, transparent engagement between the municipality, the IMT, and the facility. They showed us their test results, and we took duplicate samples. While we were taking samples, they were also taking their own samples, and then we'd get together at the end and share results and see whether they are telling us the same story. So that was also done. And repeat sampling to date testing indicates that no listeria is present in Rainbow Chicken Limited. And as a result, that facility has also, that prohibition notice was then withdrawn. So the facility is allowed to then operate as well. So the only outstanding facility that is still closed is Enterprise Polokwane. And they have committed that they will not cheat the system, they won't reopen until they are very sure that they have done whatever it takes, and then we'll come on board, you know, as a team and do the necessary assembly. And when we are all satisfied, that's when we then reopen the facility. In terms of recalls, the products that were implicated were recalled both locally and those that had been exported. So there was an extensive recall that was done. That was led by the National Consumer Commission and Department of Environmental Affairs. They came on board and made sure under the NCC legislation, those products were recalled, and from our staff, we then recalled those that were imported, you know, to our trade partners. And all those, there was about 5,812 tons that is currently being destroyed, and the target date is we are hoping that by the end of October 2018 we would have destroyed all that all those products that have been retained, and currently they are stored at City Deep in Joburg at a cold store with the necessary level of protection to ensure that there won't be any theft of those products. Now, in terms of food safety legislation, because that was also identified as an area of concern, training material on roles and responsibilities of inspectors were produced. The HACCP, or Hygiene Assessment and Critical Control Point regulations, were revised, and now this require that all ready-to-eat producers have to be HACCP certified, because in the past it wasn't emphasize that they have to be. It wasn't obligatory. Now at this point, now it's obligatory. Now everybody who's running a ready-to-eat a facility has to be HACCP certified. We have also worked on hygiene regulations that were published under the Foodstuffs, Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act this year under the Department of Health. And we are working on the microbiological regulations that will then guide on the levels, acceptable levels of different organisms. The NRCS has published compulsory specification on ready-to-eat for meat. The published out for comment is not yet law. There's engagement with industry and with other regulators on the document. In terms of reference for the technical experts, have been advertised and they are available on the website that has been put on that slide. Ongoing work that is there, there's consultation with industry, especially the critical aspect that we're dealing with is on the levels. We are looking at the Codex guidelines, but at the same time there is a debate as to whether that is the right way to go, because there's argument that is Codex really looking at the dynamics of, you know, African countries, or if I may call it, poorer countries? So those are different arguments that are coming on board. So at this point, instead of just imposing Codex regulations, we have taken a decision to engage with the industry to make sure that ultimately when we set standards, are standards that have been well consulted and everybody is comfortable with those standards. There is inputs from technical experts, and those inputs will then be incorporated into the revised guidelines. A training team or company will then be engaged to train all environmental health practitioners in new guidelines. And as I said earlier, we have thus far, you know, trained about 900, but then we're thinking of even outsourcing this to make sure that everybody who comes on board is trained accordingly. The next slide then talks to risk communication. We also noted that in as much as we have communication units, but not all were prepared in terms of communicating the outbreak and keeping the members of the public informed as to what is happening. So a decision was taken that health promoters will then be trained also on how to disseminate a message and not to cause panic. So sometimes you can just give out information instead of helping, you actually causing more problems. So what message you can send out there? So that was part of a training that was sent out. Community engagement activities were made. All provinces were visited by the team on communication and on food control. So people were trained in all the 9 provinces. There are websites that have been created. One is listeriosis.org, and the NICD also has a website that is current, that is constantly being updated whenever there's new developments. Health promotion activities and dissemination of literature by provinces and districts targeted at helping at-risk persons to avoid implicated products. So there is work that is also being done in provinces on this. Ongoing, honorable members may remember that Minister of Health, whenever he appears to give a message on TV or on the media, he emphasizes on the WHO 5 keys to safer food, including washing hands. You know, he's always emphasizing that. Now, that is also then being disseminated further down, you know, to provinces. Public service announcements are being made. An emphasis is on food safety in September. There was September was World Environmental Health Month, and there was a big function that was held in Bloemfontein, and this is food safety was a key area of discussion at that seminar. Now, the last slide is just, honorable members, it's basically what we have also talked about earlier. Just a summary to just show what we have done so far, that we have declared the outbreak over based on the levels that we are seeing. And number 2, the implicated products have been recalled. And number 3, no aerosols have been identified thus far. So this is the summary of where we are. And to strengthen the systems to prevent further outbreaks, we have declared it. Listeriosis has been declared a notifiable medical condition. NICD has developed surveillance systems, and there's capacity that has been created in terms of testing by the NHLS, and environmental health practitioners and veterinary public health officials have been trained. The food safety legislation is under review to look at all the legislations and make sure that there's harmony within those legislations. And that will guide us further and make sure there are no gaps that would have been identified. Communication is also being done, you know, in terms of giving the public the information that is required. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, the representative of the team that was dealing with the outbreak. Honorable members, you can engage with the report. Honorable Tolse, Honorable State.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. There's a couple of concerns that I have. And the one is, this is an outbreak, and in order to address it, we have to get in the assistance of global bodies. And so I'd like to know, is this a standard practice around the world where there's an outbreak of this nature and we get the assistance of the World Health Organizations, or is it the question of capacity within South Africa to address such outbreaks? Another concern is that you said that listeriosis has always existed and yet it had to take a major outbreak for us to start addressing it. And what guarantee do we have that there won't be similar diseases in the future where we are only going to react once there's an outbreak and the public is affected by it, and instead of preventing it from actually getting out there to start with? I think we're doing a disservice to the South African public here.
And we fingered Tiger Brand and Rainbow as well as the two main sources of these diseases. And obviously this outbreak has put a strain on our healthcare facilities, and we had to get assistance from international bodies. And we've created a frenzy out there in the public. In fact, nobody wants to eat quota anymore because it's got polonia in, and the polonia is not safe. So what sanctions will be imposed on Tiger Brands and Rainbow to make sure that in future that they take the public out there a little bit more serious and prevent similar, or as a warning to other facilities that produce food for the public, to be serious about what they put out there in the public and not affect them in this manner. That's all for now, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. Jay, I want to start with the slide that shows that, you know, it's always been there. We know it's in the system, and you can't really get rid of listeria. It's everywhere around us. So the slide that shows that we have some positive tests before the outbreak. I see in 1 month there was 25, then there was 28, then there was 31. I would just like to find out, I'm not exactly sure, the slide reads a bit difficult. At what stage did we actually respond? It's page 6. So if I can just find out from that, where did we respond? Did we respond at 46, 49, 52, late in the slide, because that one doesn't give the months and the years. The other one, the next slide, 7, gives us the months of the year. So I want to also find out what plans was in place. Even when we saw in 1 month 19, or in month, I'm not sure if it's a month, it's quite high for listeria if it's the deadly strain. So did some alarm bells ring somewhere before that the outbreak when it was so high? Then, Chairperson, I want to find out if we are also testing for other diseases like salmonella and others, because this is now focusing on one thing, which is listeria, which was a crisis. But I'm sure there must be a similar graph that shows us other diseases. South Africa is very, you know, deaths under 5 years of children is very high. So it might be that we are having other diseases that's always in hospital, you know, that we're not really reacting to because it's not a crisis at the moment. So what other tests are we doing? Then, Chairperson, on the closing of the factories, what norms and standards are we then currently using? And I'm specifically speaking to Enterprise Polokwane. If we're going to test them now, what would be the norms? Because we don't have anything in writing or in law for South African. We are still then using the international law as far as I know. But what would be the test? You must have 0 or you must have 1% or what? So what would be the norm for that? Then, Chairperson, I wanted to ask the question about the incineration of the food, because I was informed that a lot of people dumped that food and it went into the informal market. Did you find any traces of anything like that? Because my concern was that not all the food was then sent to be incinerated. Do you have some kind of a way of record to see that all the possible contaminated food then was gotten rid of in the way that's supposed to be, and then who is monitoring this incineration? Then, Chairperson, I would also like to find out if we ever found the origin, and I know there's a lot of discussion about this, but it's Dr. Molefe. You explained this whole thing of genome sequencing and all of that, and I know that you can link it to other outbreaks in other countries. You also said that you can see that it's not the ones of the lemon, the
wat lemoene of whatever in Australia, whatever. Did we link this what specific DNA test to another outbreak in another country? Because I am still of the, it must have gotten into this country in some way. So if we ever found out if it was linked to another DNA testing in any of the other countries, or are we still looking for that? And then you said that we have tested all the food coming into the country. I can recall there was a hoo-ha about the Minister of Health or someone in the health department that sent a letter to the health practitioners on the border post to say that we don't have to have to test chicken anymore because it doesn't exist in chicken. Are we now testing chicken or are we not testing chicken at the moment, or is that still in place? And then, Chairperson, the cost of this, I'm very worried, concerned that the DTI is not here. Because one of the things that I asked them last time is if they made some investigation into what the cost of this was to the industry. And I know that people's health must come first, but the almost hysteria that was, you know, everyone must stop eating any processing food, had a massive impact on specifically our pork industry, and I am not even sure if we are back on production lines. So did anyone do some kind of investigation to see what the cost was to the agricultural industry on this general ban of all processed food? And in hindsight, do you think it was the best thing to do for the minister to declare that all processed food must be, you know, no one must eat any processed food? Is there any other way? I'm thinking of going forward. Is there any other way that we could have dealt with this? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Chair. My question is on the testing. Dr. Maja said they are also not testing Dr. Melissa said they are not testing food that is not processed, deboning meat. When are they going to do that? Because they have only tested processed meat. And do they have time, do they have other measures of ensuring that in future they test periodically, or they only test when there's an outbreak? And that is my concern, because I didn't hear him saying in future this is how we're going to prevent outbreaks. So I need an answer on that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Dr. Mulefe, in the last presentation that we had, Minister of Health has made commitment that they are going to make sure that the environmental practitioners are being increased, even if they are still under municipalities. Because if you look at that level, that's where government is very weak, and those are the people who must actually monitor on daily basis these companies. So just want to check that do we have progress on that? Maybe again I should have started by welcoming the report. There is a lot of progress that has been made, and welcome even the norms and standards, because that was one of the critical elements that opened loopholes for these things to happen. And we want to appreciate that all the partners are participating in making sure that we keep these outbreaks. But I want to check, and we must even welcome the cooperation of this company that were affected. Most of them, they've cooperated with the teams as you're doing your work. Just to check on the on the maybe as a follow up question to what Honorable Steyn has said, to say that because we must be preventative in new establishments. Are we going to make sure that those secure, there is a lot of risk analysis that will be done, and make sure that we kept some of the incidents of these outbreaks. And these teams that have been established to work on the restoration, is it the team that will look at the all the, because there might be other outbreaks, or after we have kept this one and we then disperse, or we'll be looking at establishing a formidable team from government coming from all the angles of departments to look at the measures that should be put in place for any eventuality that might happen. And the most critical thing that we have been worried in is 2 years now, Dr. Melissa, which was supposed to be responded by the team that is led by the Deputy President's Office on the Food Safety Control Agency, because that is the key thing for us to be able to deal with food safety in the country. I'm not sure whether, as you're finalizing your report at some point, it will then lead to that fast-tracking of the implementation or the establishment of that food control agents. You can respond, Doctor, with your team.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'll start with the response by Honourable Member, who raised the question whether the work or the assistance by WHO, whether that was normal practice, and what could have been the reason why we ended up with WHO coming, you know, into the country. That is normal internationally. You look at countries like the U.S., even the U.S. gets assistance from WHO, even the EU gets assistance from WHO. So it doesn't mean we are lesser than them when we get international assistance. And you will note that there are various outbreaks going on around the world. Now, when you get people who are central, who are looking at an outbreak in the U.S., an outbreak in Australia, an outbreak in South Africa. Now, when they advise a country, they have much more information and knowledge on, you know, how to deal with this matter. And yes, in South Africa, we have experts, but then it helps to bring in even international experts, you know, to join heads and then get rid of the outbreak, you know, sooner. So that is a normal international practice. And the guarantees, I mean, the lesson that we have learned out of this outbreak is on early detection, but also on collaboration. Because I think that is critical. Instead of, I think this has broken the silo mentality that, you know, has always been a problem. And joining heads and joining hands, all departments, including even the army, because the army was critical there. And that showed us that we can achieve more. Instead of saying, this is my territory, you're not coming on board, you know, I'll deal with this one. When we went to a facility, it was everybody there, you know, and everybody went there with their legislation, and then we would discuss how this must be approached under each different legislation. So the lesson that we learned there is that we need to communicate more, we need to do more inspections of facilities, and we need to share ideas, but also we need to create capacity, because that is why we then decided to even continue with the training. Everybody new who gets employed in government has to undergo this training. But this training is not only limited to listeriosis. It's training on food safety, how then a regulator handles food safety. So this will include issues like salmonella, will include campylobacter, will include, you know, all other pathogens or microorganisms of importance. So it's not just limited to listeriosis. Now, in terms of the sanctions by, you know, that should be due to these companies, and unfortunately I cannot talk to that. I know there's a lawsuit that is currently, you know, on the table, and I'm not sure how far that has gone so far. But you will know that under Competitions Commission, you know, under the National Consumer Commission, you know, they have the authority and the power to issue fines. Unfortunately, I cannot talk on their behalf. I'm not sure exactly how they are handling this matter, but we know that people have been encouraged to do what is right. If it means going to court and challenging, you know, Tiger Brand and Rainbow, people have been informed that they have that right. The Minister of Health has pronounced that on TV. But as I'm sitting, I cannot tell you this is how we are going to then sanction this. The sanction that is allowed in our legislation, like in the Meat Safety Act and Foodstuff Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act, were to close the facilities down and make sure that until they have cleared the outbreak, they are not going to be reopened. So that as far as we can go, but the National Consumer Commission can then take it further and then issue fines. In terms of the graph, whether we reacted late, it's because listeriosis was not a notifiable disease, and that is why it was missed. I mean, you know, take 10 different municipalities testing it. Nobody was collating that information to say that I have 5, you have 5, then there's 10, there's a problem. It only took, you know, doctors from Chris Hani Baragwanath, who then were doing their own analysis and getting information from different areas, and then they collated everything. They realized, no, this is abnormal. This is not a trend that we are used to. Therefore, let's do something about it. And that is when they then realized it's an outbreak. So yes, because it wasn't notifiable, we could have missed, you know, if it was notifiable, we could have reacted earlier. But we were thinking that now that it's notifiable, everybody, when they test, they send, you know, the results centrally to NICD, and NICD is collating that information. And we'll know immediately there's a spike in future. We'll know it immediately, and then we'll react, you know, to that. And as I emphasize, this work is not only then going to be limited to listeriosis. And we have emphasized in the IMT, in the incident management team, that we shouldn't deceive ourselves to say listeriosis was the only problem. Before even listeriosis, we've been struggling with salmonella, we've been struggling with other diseases, and therefore that work should continue. And if we can escalate it to a level that we are dealing with listeriosis, that would be wonderful, and that is something that we are bringing on the table. The incident management team has been disbanded because that was just focusing on listeriosis. But unofficially, the membership of that team, except the WHO, because WHO came in under listeriosis, but the three departments are continuing to be working together and sharing ideas just to make sure that we don't end up where we are. Like the legislation review that is being done, it's ongoing work by the three departments. All the draft standards that are being produced are actually discussed by the team before them being sent out, and when you get inputs, we meet and then we share ideas on that. So we have taken a conscious decision that we are not just dealing with listeriosis, but it's all food safety related issues, and that's where we are. Now, in terms of the who is monitoring recourse, it's under the Department of Environmental Affairs. They are the ones who are monitoring the destruction of all those products that have been recalled. Now, the environmental health practitioners in municipalities were also then required to be on the lookout and investigate what has happened to those products that come from kitchens and not necessarily from retail, because those from retail went directly, you know, to City Deep, but those that come from kitchens, where did they end up? Now, there isn't any report that says these products were dumped in this landfill site or this area and people ended up being sick out of it. You know, environmental practitioners were going out, but nobody was then reporting that there's a crisis because of what came out of the kitchen and end up maybe being consumed by other people. So it could have been a problem there, but there's no evidence, you know, scientific evidence to say that there was an issue there. Now, in terms of linking this outbreak with other outbreaks elsewhere, and this is why the WHO then became critical, because then they were bringing all expertise and all information that they have from, you know, all over the world. And the answer was that this ST6 had not been linked to any other outbreak from elsewhere. It's still a mystery as to how did it end up here. But we must acknowledge that the, you know, outbreaks will come from even South Africa. We cannot say it came from outside South Africa, but we cannot also say it came from within South Africa. We don't know at this point. And the WHO then advised us that I think you are now putting more focus on finding the source instead of moving forward. You tried your best to find where it comes from. Now we don't know where it comes from. Now put steps to make sure that it doesn't come back. And that is why from DAF we were monitoring mechanically deboned meat. And that is a raw product that is still going to be utilized to make this polonies and the like. Now the WHO also then said, guys, you have done your best. You have been testing MDM all this time and you're not getting any ST6, you know, in MDM. So what's the point of continuing to do it? Because when you look at Codex guidelines, raw products, there's not even a limit for raw meat. So when you test it, you are just testing to find whether it's there or not. But you cannot say at this level it's harmful, at this level it's not harmful, because that product is still going to be subjected to heat treatment. So it's still going to be cooked. And then after cooking, that's when you can then test it. And that's where there's a limit after being cooked. So the advice that we're getting is that let's forget about where it comes from, but still be on the lookout to make sure that we have systems to make sure that if it comes in, we are on the alert and we will be able to catch it while it's still at the lower levels. So that is what we are doing now. The letter by the Department of Health that was sent out to the port officials, that letter was sent out because the port officials' colleagues were doing a specific testing for U.S. meat. Honorable members will remember that when we did the AGOA negotiations, there was a package that was put in terms of how to deal with U.S. port, including the testing, including how we deal with salmonella and the like. Now, the Department of Health had an additional role that is not a normal role that they usually take in terms of imported products. So they had a role to play in terms of testing there. But agriculture still continued. So when that letter was issued out to withdraw the testing, that was only on health, but agriculture still continued to do their work and continue testing, you know, everything as if there's no letter. So that continued. So that letter had no impact in terms of us continuing our surveillance. The costing of listeriosis analysis. The Department of Trade and Industry has actually started a study now to determine the cost of the listeriosis in terms of the commercial value, or you know, how much it costs the country. So we are still waiting for the results, and once those are made available, I suppose, you know, Parliament will be, you know, sent a copy of that. Then the, yes, the periodic testing, and also the issue of new establishments, and also how do we make sure that in future we do not get this. As I said, that premises or establishments are now required to be HACCP certified. HACCP is Hygiene Assessment Critical Control Point. Now, that system, in short, it says when you run a facility, first of all, you must identify the hazards yourself, not government. You, as a facility owner, food business operator, you must identify the hazards. You say there's glass here, you say there's dung or there's this thing. Those are your hazards. And then you also then have to say, how am I going to mitigate against this? What measures am I going to put in place? And how am I going to monitor this? So you have to set a team that is going to work on those. Now, when government comes in, government does their own monitoring, but they also assess your own in-house systems that are HACCP, So both, there's an obligation both from the regulator and the food business operator to make sure that there's no hazards, or if there are hazards, because you cannot say there would not be hazards, but you clearly identify those hazards. And listeriosis has to be one of the hazards that they have to list. If a food business operator doesn't identify salmonella or listeriosis and is dealing with ready-to-eat products, then there's something wrong with it. And I don't think any municipality will then allow them to operate, you know, because that should be part of their hazard HACCP analysis. So it's about constant monitoring that they are putting those HACCP systems into place. And we have had assurances that municipalities will, you know, will improve their work on that. But in terms of the question by Honorable Chairperson, in terms of the capacity by the environmental, I'm not sure, unfortunately, you know, from whether the Minister of Health has been able to capacitate, you know, the environmental practitioners in the municipalities. So I won't be able to say that there has been any progress on that, and I'll then send the message out to the colleagues to then give update to Parliament on that matter. Now, I've also answered the issue about the team, whether the team is continuing. Yes, outside of the formal incident management team structure, we are still continuing with the work. And finally, on the issue of the food safety agency, we indicated that there's a legislative review that is being done. So there's an advert that has gone out to find a lawyer who's will be able to look at all the legislations and then say, this handles this part, this handles this part, there's a gap here, now how do you address it? Now, based on that outcome, we'll then be able to know what is the next step forward, because when we are sitting as technical aspects, we may know food legislation, but in terms of how then to structure that, we need guidance from somebody who then do the analysis. So the work in terms of how we progress with the food safety agency will be guided by the review that we'll get. Because the review can say you need the agency, or you just need to improve your structures in this particular way, and you can still do it within the current system that you have. So we're not sure, you know, how we'll be guided on that one. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, any follow-up questions? Honourable Kappa.
Thank you, Chair. My follow-up question was somehow originally my question, because my question was whether they are continuing to find out the source. Now, the response makes it to be a follow-up, because to me it becomes a concern that it seems they have come to a cul-de-sac, that now, because because it was important to find out the solution, which was very important, and these achievements are appreciated. But now, to me, if the one which I always think is always the important element in investigation, the source, if now it is ruled that we have stopped to find out the source, where does that take us? That worries me, because it gives the impression as if maybe there's fear that if this source is known, something will happen to someone. I don't know whether you needed some declaration of immunity before this thing is done, because to me, it should be, even if it's at a not in intensive or extensive rate now, but to me, it appears to me that it would have been useful if trying to find the source continues to be there, because at some stage we don't know whether there is any other source, because if we know, maybe it will help us to prevent any other form. But it's important that all these other actions have been taken. Thank you, Chair.
Dr. Mulisa.
Thanks, Chairperson. Maybe I need to clarify that when we're saying we have not found the source and the approach is that we do not necessarily have to spend all resources there, it doesn't mean we have completely stopped there. If Honourable Member looks at the slides that we have up there, surveillance still continues. Now, with surveillance, you're still trying to find out if there are outbreaks, and when you find, or actually not outbreak, incidences, and when you find an incident, you then have to find out where it comes from. So that is continuing, but to find out exactly where this one from Enterprise came from, we are at a point where we are thinking we may not find it, but everybody is doing their work there. Maybe along the way we will find where it comes from, but right now we're not sure, and we were advised that it could have even come into the facility years ago, but it was hiding maybe in the drains or hiding in the fence, and everybody was going on, you know, as usual, until then something happened and then it came out. Now, when you find that, you don't know that, you know, it came into the factory 2 years ago. But like I'm saying, DAF is continuing to monitor imports or imported MDM and other raw material. Municipalities are going on with the surveillance. NICD is going on with the surveillance, but not at any intensity to find the exact cause of ST6. But all the work that has to be done under a notifiable disease, which includes surveillance, is still continuing.
Okay, Honorable Say. Sorry, Chair, I was just wondering when the word ST6 came up. Listeria, is it a disease that can mutate? So you mutate. You can have a ST4, whatever, and then over time it then becomes a ST. Also, are we just testing specifically for ST6, or is it also something, can we have one of the other spores that can also then cause a disease? I'm just thinking, and I was also thinking when you said, you know, for years we have been struggling with salmonella. I know that we've been having salmonella, but are we going to start some or other campaign, or hopefully not again stop eating chicken, so that we now force the chicken industry also to have a problem, but in something that's almost a constant thing that we can do to ensure that people are more food safe.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. In terms of the information that we have by the experts, we were advised that ST6 can never end up being another ST, you know, something. So, but there are various ST types, you know, that are there. Now, the testing, when you do whole genome sequencing, it tells you if it's Listeria, which Listeria it is. So it won't just say it's ST6 or not, but it will tell you if it's not ST6, it's ST, this number. But any listeria has a potential to make people sick. So even when you find a non-ST6 listeria, you still have to react to that, because in terms of the Foodstuffs, Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act, food ready-to-eat products should not have any contaminant. Now, whether it's ST6 or not, it's still a contaminant, and that food should be rejected. And this is what happened to Rainbow. Rainbow did not test for ST6. It tested for listeriosis, which was not ST6. But because the law says it's a contaminant, so they had to be closed as well. So the reaction is not only on, say, ST6, it's on all contaminants that are there. Now, we're also then working with the industry, the pork industry, the poultry industry, on what you call pathogen reduction programs. The idea here is, especially with livestock and with poultry, to deal with the pathogens or these microorganisms while still on the farm, so that by the time they get to abattoirs, you have reduced the number of potential hazards there. So the pathogen reduction programs is what you implement on the farm, including vaccinations, including making sure that there's no wet areas and all those things, so that at the end, when you send poultry or chickens to an abattoir, there's less salmonella on their skins and all the like, so that there's chances of it ending up on the other side or be, you know, going into the meat. So that's what we are engaging with industry on.
Thank you very much for the update. We appreciate the progress. But as Parliament, we believe that the work should not stop, because we are now at the stage where we're in a control. We believe that we should be ready, because of the climate change. Obviously, we are going to have a lot of challenges as we go on. We need to be ready as government to deal with any outbreaks that will come, and have capacity, build our capacity, particularly at the level of the factory, where it matters most. And the other important area that we need to monitor is informal markets, because that's where majority of our people get their food. And we need to see how we monitor those areas such that our people get protected. And thank you very much. We appreciate the presentation. I think the message should be conveyed to various ministers for the good work, and we appreciate that. The lessons that learned in the process will make us better as government to attend to issues that affect our people. And the issue of collaboration is very important to deal with this with these issues. And thank you very much, Doctor. Dr. Hoboko, those lost people, are they here now? Okay. Can we have a briefing?
Honorable Chair, my name is Ellen Mabey. I'm the Director for Statistics and Economic Analysis from the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. We have been asked to come and talk to your meeting about the activities around the performance of agriculture, forestry and fisheries economy, reflecting more on the current quarterly performance of the economy in the past two quarters, and also to indicate areas where there's low productivity and which led to the poor performance of the GDP and employment. So our presentation is going to just give the background on the industry and some of the activities that has impacted on this issue.
Because you've come late in our meeting, were you not supposed to apologize to members for arriving late?
That is a mistake on my part, Chair. My apologies for that.
Yes.
My apologies for being late. We were struggling to locate the venue, but eventually we made it, and thanks for the patience you had for us. Okay. So moving on to the presentation, this is our table of contents. Quite a number of issues that we are going to look at. As a background for this, on this information, we are looking at this past two quarters on performance, but this is in the background on the past four quarters of 2017, where the AFF sector has been leading in performance against other sectors, and this was due to the deep rains after we suffered low production due to drought in the early 2016. Though the Western Cape drought lagged behind in 2017, and its impact was not visible until lately, and this is why it has been revealing itself and showing impact on the GDP. Another issue is that there have been some late harvests from the summer field crops, which are happening between quarter one and quarter two. These late harvests that are lagging also have some level of impact in the current economic activity, particularly our biggest crop, which is maize. As we have gathered the information from Status A, these are the GDP figures from their publications, which now we are focusing it on agriculture, forestry and fisheries. The 33% that happened in quarter one this year between January and March, and then April to June is the 29.2, which was reported recently. And indeed, there is very much inevitable that these figures have been there as a result of this drought that we are facing in Western Cape and the delay in some of the harvesting activities for the summer crops. The one thing that is happening when we do the economic analysis for different industries is that we can analyze the information comparing quarter to quarter. If we also are comparing quarter two this year, then we also comparing the same with the same quarter in the year before. For example, quarter two in 2017 will be the relevant quarter, or we can compare this quarter with the preceding quarter. But for agriculture, because of its seasonality and the volatility between the seasons, and the fact that harvesting happens at a particular time in different, in particular quarters, it's best to do that comparison between this current quarter and the quarter in 2017, the same quarter in 2017. And this is where we have to apply methodologies like seasonally adjusted, and that is why your economic performance when you compare it with the preceding quarter will be different from when you compare it with the same quarter in the past year. So that is something that we must note, that it depends from which angle are you analyzing the information. So you can see when we compare this quarter and last quarter, the impact is much higher than if we compare quarter 2 2018 with quarter 2 2017. One of the biggest drivers of the agricultural economy is our maize and our sunflower, among some of the biggest commodities. And because when we account for these economic figures, we look at what has been delivered in the commercial structures. For example, we have our silos that receive a large stock of maize. And what happens between quarter to quarter or season to season has an impact on how the economy does, because the quantities that are received in those structures at a particular quarter will give you an indication how much will production be. For example, that yellow bar line on maize between quarter 2 in 2017 and quarter 2 now in 2018, you can see the difference. Last year we had a huge bumper crop, which was around 16.8 million. That's why our economy performed so well, and that's the reason why I'm saying maize is one of our biggest economic drivers. And now, with a lower outlook of maize this current year, that is why our delivery is at that level that it is, and it's moving much slower than before. And the main thing here is because farmers are delivering, but because of this late harvest, some of the stock is still slowly making its way to the silos, but the estimation is a bit lower than last year, and this you know creates some kind of a dip in the economy. And if you can look at the overall correlation between what you see on the agricultural GDP and the income or the value added by the maize, you will see there's a large correlation. So maize has a very strong influence on this. And hence, the situation, it is what it is at the moment. Some of the crops that have been affected by drought in Western Cape, we looked into those. Grains from some of them, because remember, with winter crops in Western Cape, we have wheat and canola and some of the small crops. So they have been highly impacted by between 20 to 30%. But then your wine grapes, your palm fruit, your stone fruit also have slightly been impacted. And you will think this is a very small impact, but if you think about 40% of this rand and cents are end in the economy by trade activities that are happening with these commodities, then it tells you that any slight decline on these commodities that are exported, it has a serious impact on the economic account. So this is one of the biggest contributors. Now, looking at the contribution of the different commodities, you can see with maize, when you compare quarter one and quarter two, there has been a slight increase. Because, you know, this slow delivery that is happening due to late harvest has started to pick up. According to our sources, most of the deliveries are going to be finalized in quarter three. So you will see a large jump, even higher than this current green bar on maize. And then compare quarter 2017 and quarter 2018, then you see that decline that I'm talking about, that, you know, after the bumper crop that happened in 2017, then we are slowly lagging into 2018 quarter two. And because of this, it has had some bit of an impact in the economy. And then when you look at your deciduous fruits and vegetables, so some of which have been produced in the Western Cape, you see a serious decline between quarter one and quarter two, and, you know, really because of the drought. And you know, this is one of the two areas that that have had an impact. Your citrus is quite dramatic in growth, and I think it's because seasonally it is time for them to harvest, and this really has brought a little bit of a softer blow to the current minuses that we are having. As you can see, we moved from minus 33 to minus 26-29%. So this is some of the things that have contributed. Your cattle and poultry are quite stable in production. Cattle in particular, we are talking about a case where during the drought season there was a lot of slaughtering, selling of livestock, farmers getting rid of the stock because they are afraid it will die because there's not enough grazing land. But then, as we moved along, they started building stock, you know, selling more, acquiring more stock for their livestock. So there is a bit of a pickup on that trend, which keeps the supply of livestock, slaughtered meat stable. This graph shows your gross income per agricultural subsector. And this is the phenomenon I'm talking about when you are looking at your field crops, which include maize as the biggest contributor, against what is your total total income of that. So there's a thorough correlation. So even if you have your horticultural issues there, the impact is not as high as what you see when there is changes in the maize stock. Your dark blue line is about your animal products, which involves your beef and poultry, which are the biggest contributors. And you can see the instability there. That slight decline, it refers to how product prices have stabilized and decreased a bit because the supply of meat is starting to grow after the drought. We then touched on forestry and fisheries issue. The imports of forestry have gone up a bit, and when we did some research, we realized that it's because during the times of drought, a lot of the trees were cut, and now since that period, most of the foresters are starting to grow their trees at a very small stage. And so production is not as high as it's supposed to be. And then we are importing more from areas like our SADC areas, Botswana, Swaziland. We are picking up a supply from there. And hence, this is why our picture on forestry is the way.
Sorry, Chairperson, we have a different presentation. My page 10 is like this. We don't have this one on forestry even in here. What happened?
Chair, we made some changes in the afternoon. We forgot to update our communication. But some of the forestry and fisheries slides, they're still there.
Wait.
On that presentation. They are not there. Okay.
We are trying to follow, but we don't.
It's not there. Oof, it's a terrible mistake on our side, Chair.
No, it's only agriculture. There is no forestry and fisheries. Just proceed, forget those things, the presentation later. Honorable members, if you feel that you will not discuss without the presentation on fishery and forestry, you can still receive that presentation, and then we'll put it on the agenda for the next meeting.
I think there must proceed, Chair. It's a very important discussion, but
okay.
Just to note that we don't have this slide.
All right.
My apologies. Then we look at forestry. The same goes in terms of exports. Checking with the other main sources that we normally use, which is our trade map, we pick up that a lot of our consumers, they're going more for your imported tinned fish, which creates more room for importing more. And as we pick up the slow growth of the aquaculture production, we realize most of those products, even though they are growing, most of these commodities are consumed domestically in the market, and so less and less of them are being exported. So there is those dynamics of how consumers behave towards fish. So most of this fish that is produced domestically in its different forms is consumed domestically, as there is a tendency for communities to start eating more healthy type of protein. So this is the phenomenon that is expressed by that. I think more investment into our aquaculture activities can lead us to eventually try and export more, especially the most expensive type of fish like your pearl moon and so on. The slide on agribusiness confidence is put in there to indicate the perceptions of farmers as investors in the agricultural space. Their intention to plant, their intention to invest in their capital, their physical facilities in their own areas of operation. That is an indication of how the farmers perceive the environment that they are operating on. And this is normally has very minimal correlation with the GDP. If we can put the GDP line, you can see that the correlation is not very, very far. There's a number of indices that are used in this, but we picked up the ones that seems to be having an impact. With that 50-point mark, it's the deciding mark that tells us whether it's a positive or negative sentiment. In this past quarter, it is now 48, which has gone down 6 points below from quarter two estimate, and it's influenced by sub-indices like your unemployment, your capital investment confidence, your export volumes, and economic growth. Particularly the unemployment, you know, the perception is that there's not much unemployment, there's no opportunities to create employment because of the environment that they're in, and the issues are lingering on policy uncertainty makes it difficult for them to create more opportunities for employment. The capital investment, most of these farmers, they cannot buy physical equipment and expand their buildings or spend money on anything that is infrastructure-wise because there is this overall policy uncertainty, especially on land expropriation without compensation. That's a big issue for them. So it's a sort of a wait-and-see type of environment. And so it ends up influencing things like your export volumes and the fact that there is slow economic growth, you know, those are the effects and the after-effects of this. So farmers, the overall issue is that farmers have feel a lot of policy uncertainty, and they wish that the issue of land expropriation without compensation can be resolved so that they can move forward. According to a discussion with some of the industry experts, they feel that this line can easily pick up to beyond 60 very quickly if some of the things are resolved. The overall agricultural environment, they seem to see it as something very positive. The fact that we are starting to have good rains, the prices are good, and we are starting to establish some good markets for export, both in the Western and the African market. They foresee a lot of good potential going through. And the fact that the current government is open to discussion on things like your job summit, your stimulus packages, agriculture is considered there. So they see a lot of positiveness in the environment, just if they can be assured about their land rights when it comes to land expropriation without compensation or a clear policy direction on that. Then we look at some of the factors that influence the profitability of farmers, your total farming in debt. And, you know, the the main thing is that we have your land bank as one of the providers of production loans, your commercial banks, as well as some of the agricultural cooperatives, and of course the Department of Agriculture in the form of maybe grants and things like that that help to bring funding into the picture. Your total farming in debt, if you look between 2014, 15, 16, most of that has been mainly influenced by the issue of drought, when farmers were making low production, but they were even willing to go further in terms of getting more loans. And to some extent, you can see that farmers, you know, they do pursue their farming activities despite harsh activities, because they believe in the coming years they're going to rip off more, especially when they start watching prices and seeing how things are working out, or they see prospects of increasing production. So, you know, the loans are there, and they believe, even though the loans are difficult to cope with, you know, they're always willing to risk themselves in terms of that. But the main thing is, where are they spending the loans? Production loans are things that come and go within a space of a year, because then they're paying for fertilizers, and when the harvest comes, they make enough to pay off that loan immediately, and then they remain with something. But the main thing is, are they getting those loans to provide physical investment that lasts on the farm? And that's the commitment we're struggling with. And this type of loan is always vulnerable to things like your exchange rate, the increase in oil prices, and you know, so it keeps going up because of those things. Then the main input cost in terms of your intermediary goods and services, farm fees are the main driver, and you know, farm fees come from things like your maize that is used for feed, your soya beans. So these are the biggest cost drivers for your chicken feed, your livestock feed, and farmers really, you know, they really struggle under this. Because if you think about it, in the times of drought, when our maize was very low, they had to import a lot of this maize that they used to feed, and that came with a lot of exchange rate costs that is imported when you bring it in. The same phenomenon is observed when you think about fertilizers. Fertilizers are one of the biggest cost drivers, and things like fuel in cases where particularly the exchange rate is very high, because that is imported, is an imported input cost as well. So our input costs keep rising, and we should really look at how best can we overcome this. What investment production facilities can we provide? Should we drive industry to invest more on domestic fertilizer production? Do we have the resources to do that? The case in point is your soya bean as an input cost, a farm feed, that we are turning the corner in terms of soya bean. If we had plotted in the graph, you would see that our trade balance on soya bean is starting to be very positive. We are heading to the surplus side, because more of this product is no longer being imported. Your oil cake is being produced locally, and our farmers are buying at an affordable price locally. So those are the things that we must look at in terms of fertilizers, and how can we turn around issues of fuel? Can we use our own produce, to a certain of our own produce, to come up with biofuel and work on domestic infrastructure to produce these things domestically and cut costs for our farmers to produce. Now, how profitable is the farming business is the issue here, because if businesses are not profitable, it does have an impact on the economy. So the environment should allow for farmers to be profitable. You have your line on total farming in debt, and our gross capital formation, which refers to your physical investment, and the net farm income. So between the red line and the green line on the total farming debt and the net farm income, it's quite a healthy picture, given that you know, debts can come from other areas besides just your normal mainstream. But that line on the gross capital formation needs to improve, because once you have your stable infrastructure or on the farm, you know, infrastructure has an influence on how profitable your farm is or how profitable your business is in the long term. And most of these farmers, when we talk to industry, we realize that they don't physically invest in equipment and things. They just maybe rent a tractor, rent machinery, or outsource other activities like processing their maize and things like that. So we need to have that physical infrastructure investment increased in the country, mobilize industry or support industry in investing physically in the farm. And that works very closely with this lingering policy uncertainty on land expropriation. They don't know if I buy machinery that helps me to milk or buy a chicken house or that help a facility that helps me to milk my cattle. Will I own that land, or is somebody, is government going to take that land from me? So those things have an influence on how they invest on infrastructure. So it's something that our land expropriation without compensation is going to have an influence on. You know, this is the impact of it, and that we could change that graph and turn things around if we make the decision favorably to the business environment. Employment is a main indicator as well. 843,000 is how much more or less is reported when it comes to number of people employed in this sector. This graph shows that the proportion of about two-thirds of employment is taken over by your food crops and horticulture, but more your horticulture, because that is more labor intensive. So the figures are always hovering around that area. I think in the past 12 months, maybe the biggest loss has been around 20,000 or so. And mainly, like other indicators in agriculture, is based on season. Like during the times of harvest with horticulture, you will see most of the employment is increasing around that time. You know, though we have something like 3,000 loss in this past quarter, you pick up that, you know, in a normal season when there's no drought, during this time of quarter one and quarter two, your employment is somehow picking up, because especially in this area of horticulture and agriculture. So very little contribution is made by your livestock and other commodities. So your biggest contributor to jobs is horticulture, and that is what industry is proposing that we should drive towards, investing more in horticulture production activities that can increase employment. And of course, this is just a picture of what the status of employment is between quarter 1, 2018, quarter 2, 2018. We made losses of about 3,000, slightly below 4,000 number of employment. And of course, with this issue of horticulture being impacted by drought in the Western Cape, most of these losses are in those areas. So we are observing that. But more or less, this is also at the level at which employment is standing. All these issues have an impact on inflation. For example, if you look at where we come from with drought towards the end of 2017, most of these prices are going down. Your bread and cereal, which is your maize, your wheat products, they are coming down. Your fruits are coming down in terms of prices. And we are still enjoying the fruits of good rains from 2017 in terms of prices. If you look, fish is picking up in its own way, but then there is this issue of supply and domestic supply, which would maybe have an impact on that. The fact that some consumers are preferring imported fish, that could have an impact on that. Your meat is nicely slowing down since quarter four of 2017, and is because of this phenomenon of the drought when the supply is starting to pick up because farmers have now built their stock and the slaughtered meat is starting to pick up. And then this larger supply of meat then is having a softer blow on the price, which is very good for the consumer out there. Water is a very important factor in agriculture. As you know, the fact about drought is that there's no water. So we are watching the dam levels. And around the country, most of the provinces, the levels are at a very healthy level, mostly above 40% towards 60. If you look at Gauteng, we're almost at 100. The same with more or less Northern Cape, quite good. Western Cape is slowly picking up. It's currently at 66%, as you can see, since October the 8th, the figures that we have. And yeah, when you compare the total level of dams between October 2017 and October 18, October 2018, you're talking at about 74% nationally in terms of dam levels. And that's another thing that our confidence index is depending on, that, you know, our dam levels gives farmers an indication that there is prospects for growth. And so these are the elements that are in play right now in terms of our economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Honorable members, you can engage with the presentation. Honorable Papa, Honorable Stein, Honorable Chew.
Thank you, Chair, and also thank you for the presentation. I only have a few comments maybe where I need some clarity. One is another impression of productivity, but I don't know whether in this case the production levels and productivity are interchangeable in this presentation. The second one, I'm not clear about this. There's a lot of mention of the issue of land expropriation without compensation. I was under the impression that no harvest has been realized yet after the parliament has passed this resolution, or even after the ANC has passed in the conference in December. But now I'm just want to get a clarity how this can be related to the productivity at this stage. Some clarity on the source of information. Maybe there are several sources. Now there are only other two elements that I thought they are missing. One is that I don't find a mention of a big number of people who are referred to as subsistence farmers who might be contributing to the low productivity for other reasons, mainly because maybe they don't have resources, which is most likely. And then the other one is that also I think it's a miss not to mention of fuel costs. Maybe I missed it, the fuel costs, the rise of this petrol and other things, which definitely affect farmers, whereas it is not plan, it is not their plan, or it's not tally with their resources. I know that for a fact that in most cases, farmers, why I mentioned this fuel cost thing, farmers are always on the receiving end, because when they have to buy their inputs, someone determines the prices. Again, when they have to sell their input, their products, still someone has to determine the prices. So I just need some clarity on these issues where I think maybe I didn't get it clear. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. I think it gives us some good insight. Chair, I'm on the slide, the one that's talking about the profitability of the farming business with this one. I'm not sure if we are now on the same slides. Looking at this, I can see that from 2007-08, every year there was a steep rise on the total farming debt. Did you do some kind of analysis of what the reasons for this is? I know there's other slides that speaks about the fuel and all of that, but what would be the main driving cost of all of this? It's impossible for it just to be a drought or this or that, because it's every year. Something must have changed, because if you look up till 2007, you can see, you know, it was a slight almost increase, but something drastically happened in 2007. So did you do some inspection or analysis on what the reason for that is? Then, Chairperson, the other question that I want to ask is on slide 14 on my slide. I'm not sure if yours is 14. It's expenditure on intermediate goods and services. Looking at this, one of the issues, I think we all know about farm feeds and fuel and what, but one of these ones is farm services. It's the blue one. It's the third one, the line. So what would farm services be? It's this slide. If you can maybe just unpack exactly, because I look at all the others and I understand exactly what they are, but if you can give me the farm services. And then, Chairperson, on slide 12, on the different commodities, there's, when we talk about the decrease on the value add for import and export, since Dr. Maja is here, I'm going to take the opportunity to look at the yellow band because of avian flu and avian influenza of ostrich feathers and produce. Are we moving along trying to get that back? Because it obviously, I know it's a small amount. I think I did ask a question once, what is the total value of that? But at least, you know, it is something that is maybe in our hands that we can do something about. And then, Chair, there was a lot of noise made with the increase of fuel prices currently, and the farmers said the 1st of October is the planting season, that fuel price increases at the same time. What do you think the effect of that would be? Because I think the combination with the uncertainty of expropriation and the fuel price increases is troublesome. We are trying ourselves to see if there's already people that don't plant because of this. I think people are changing commodities. Can you make almost a prediction to look at, you know, because grains is our biggest cost driver for, but if people start moving into other commodities, how big will that be, you know, in the impact if people move to other commodities?
Chair, thank you very much. I want to appreciate the presentation. My question is based on what Honorable Kapa just said on expropriation without compensation, because it was only announced in 2017, but starting from 1994, on this slide 16, the profitable how profitable is the farming business? Farming business from 1994, it was very low and then it went up like that, but it also goes up and down, it fluctuates. But the main issue that the presenter raised was the policy issue, and the policy was not there in 1994. So what were the causes? If you can outline that. And then you go to slide 18. Women are in very low numbers. It's at 278 in 2018, second quarter. And the male figure is very, very high. So taking agriculture as a sector that can employ as many women as possible, even unskilled women can be employed in the agricultural sector, but that is not happening. And historically, agriculture has always been a women's sector. So what went wrong? And even the income gap, you're not even analyzing the income gap between male and female in the sector. I don't know where we are. So in terms of inequalities in the sector, I think we need that analysis so that we can understand how can we grow the economy, including more women into the economy. We can't continue undermining that the economy is undermining women, and we continue analyzing the economy in the same way. I think we must change, especially that is analyzed by yourself as women. So we must pull in as many women as possible into the agricultural sector. But you must help us because you are experts on how we can grow the economy, getting more women participating. So if I can have more slides that talks on the inequalities of women within the agricultural sector. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, I want to agree that some of the cost drivers, as you have mentioned, which are horticulture affected by drought in Western Cape, but you've picked up the important element, which is the biggest contributor to the economy, which is the maize. But you have not given the reason why the maize has actually declined. You talk about, maybe I didn't pick it up, when you talk about the harvest, you are referring to the maize. But the second issue that you are not talking about, which the Grain SA was talking about, was the loss of land to the other development in the provinces. The maize, and which is it's something that you as agriculture, you're supposed to protect this land, and you're not doing that. Even if you have not managed to pass legislation, the PIDALFA, but there is a CARA which you're supposed to have utilized to protect this land of agriculture. You've not done that. And you're not mentioning it in your presentation. The second issue is on the reasons that Honorable Trapp and Chu are raising on this land expropriation without compensation, and how it has affected the contribution, which it cannot be true, because the effect of that decision is supposed to be still has to come, because it was not because if you look at the, for instance, you've mentioned the issue of the infrastructure at the farm, which is which is something that made farmers not invest in the farm. But you don't talk about the land reform program, that you went out and remove the infrastructure in the farm and give black farmers land without that infrastructure. And most of the farms, they were productive as you bought them, but because you have removed the infrastructure, then give black farmers the farm without infrastructure. It has affected, it had its own contribution, and we are not mentioning it here. When we talk about land reform not working, we are not talking about how we have actually, as we said, sold or else we agree with those people who are owning farms, make them to remove the infrastructure, take over the rights. They, your presentation does not pick up those issues. And you jump to the land expropriation, which has just been taken yesterday. And we should be honest with our analysis and therefore be able to help government to make proper decisions. Because so far as I'm seated here, I've not get any farmer that has said I've not planted because there is a land expropriation decision by Parliament. So I've not get that farmer who says that. So, and all of them, as was met with them, including Grain SA, they are saying we should look at how we implement this decision so that it doesn't affect the productivity of, and they are talking about productivity, which is not the which is not the the production itself. Productivity means the increment of what you have. So because if you want to expand the economy, you have to increase the farming. But so they are saying that the land of expropriation, if it's not implemented to protect that environment, we might get affected. But to associate decline to that decision, for me, I'm not convinced. And you see, if we can just analyze, because people are talking and intimidating people who have taken decision, it's not right. Technical people must give honest analysis so that the proper decision can be made. So, seated here, I'm part of those people who have voted for that land appropriation without compensation. But you are already starting to intimidate me that the decision that you have taken is very wrong, and you are technical people that are supposed to say the decision has been taken. This is how we should move forward with speed for us to make sure that the productivity does not get affected. So that's the problem I'm having with this, with your analysis.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'll just start from the first questions that came through. The more pronounced issue that was raised was on this issue that land expropriation land expropriation without compensation, how can it be?
I forgot one thing. On the employment, one of the issues that has been raised is the eviction of farm workers. That is happening, and it has happened even before the decision has been taken, and South Africans have been replaced by foreign nationals. So as we do the analysis, are we including labor such that their research can enrich us, so that when we bring solution, we'll then be able to deal with the solution in terms of reality.
The issue of land expropriation without compensation, I could have maybe mentioned things in a way that could be a bit confusing, but what I'm trying to emphasize here is that production is taking place, and but farmers are cautious about how far they are willing to invest. But doesn't mean that production is not happening. But farmers are on a wait and see, and that's what that confidence interval, that confidence picture is saying. You know, it's just the mindset that is in the country that is waiting, maybe 3 months to 6 months, waiting to see, you know, how is it going to be implemented from the farmer's side. but production is taking place. You know, if you look at the part of maize as one of our key drivers, we had a bumper crop last year, which ended in quarter four of 2017. The season is at its beginning now in terms of harvesting, and the only reason why there is that delay is because of this late planting that took place in October last year. Remember, every year the planting season starts. So the late rains that started then created this late harvesting. And because when we account for these figures, we use the figures that are reported to us in terms of the deliveries that are going into the silos. That is why there is this lag. It's nothing close to the issue of you know, farmers not producing because of land expropriation. In this case, it's simply your market phenomenon issues and the fact that the rain started late and the harvesting is just simply slowly coming in, not at a high level as it is. When we checked some of our figures for quarter 3, 2018, that's when most of this maize will be even higher. At now, our forecast is around about 13 million. And with a harvest that is still at a surplus from last year of about 4 million tons, we're still at your 17 million bumper crop that we are foreseeing this current year. So that's the reason why things are the way they are. The issue that I tried to emphasize that could be the reason why there is that is impacted by land expropriation without compensation is this issue of grass capital formation, which expresses how low farmers invest in infrastructure. And of course, the other issues that you raise in terms of land reform, why some of those farms, the infrastructure was destroyed and things like that. But generally, remember, we are now analyzing at your main stream commercial space where farmers have got land that produces about 70 to 90% of food in the country, your high commercial land. The level at which they physically, with the money in their pocket, invest in things like your pack house, your chicken infrastructure, your dipping tanks, facilities to produce input costs and things like that, they are highly slow and cautious of doing those things because they don't know in the next 2 years will they still own this land or not. And it's not because they don't want to invest. They're just waiting to see where the decision is going. So it's just naturally for any commercial person who is using their own money to decide, am I going to make losses or not? The other reason why we might not have proper accounting of these figures when it comes to land reform, farmers and your subsistence, the involvement of women, is because our data is still lacking when it comes to that. We still need to get our data on smallholder farmers and do this type of analysis on their farms that they have to see how much are they producing, how much is the size of their infrastructure, the worth of their infrastructure, that can truly quantify their status when it comes to these issues. That work is still being planned on and processed, and hopefully by the end of September 2020, we'll be able to give feedback on such reports, because historically, those type of statistics have not been collected and monitored like your commercial statistics are being collected. So it is one of the things that we are always debating on and putting our heads together to see how we can improve on. So I don't know, hopefully I have responded on that. So in fact, issues that relate to unemployment, eviction of farm workers, replaced by foreign nationals, it boils down to what type of statistics we collect. Our labor force survey focuses on households, which is done by State SA. Some of these indicators then need to be added in terms of the number of employers employment that is on those agricultural activity households, and also indicators that ask if there is number of foreign nationals occupying that land. That will give us a true picture of, is this a rumor or is this reality? And if it is a reality, by how much proportion is it taking the space of employment, the issue of foreign nationals? So it's a research challenge that we have to, you know, channel. How does the TSA produce these figures? Should we add some of these indicators so that it gives us the answers that we need? The mention of your involvement of women, I just wanted to emphasize that most communal lands in the rural areas is where you find your rural women employed. And this touches on us putting our heads together and finalizing plans on how do we collect statistics on agriculture that involves communal lands, because most of our statistics do not cover that area. So it will form part of your smallholder statistics issues that we are trying to improve on, and hence we are still getting into that area. Okay. What also came through very clearly is the question about your 2007-2008 costs during the crisis. My analysis of the economy overall at the time, we were facing the financial crisis, and the fact that certain things were highly costly, our exchange rate was properly highly depreciated at the time, some of these things impacted us in terms of costs. And so maybe at the time, probably farmers had to make more extra loans because they had to maybe buy more expensive inputs and other things that they need for the farm. So it could have done that. But I think, you know, the impact could have been much higher if maybe our financial system was not as strong as it was, you know, compared to most other developing countries. So we had survived it. And if you look up at it, you know, our agricultural economy at the time was quite good. It was around 7%. So it justifies the fact that with high income that came, then a lot of loans were incurred into to make sure that we maintained that high production that delivered a good economic output at the time. So that's just my memory at the time, how it works. I hope I answered all your questions. The prediction on fuel, you know, the issue with fuel is that it's influenced a lot by your exchange rate. And so the minute the exchange rate has an impact, you know, on trade, then it also has an impact on that. Also, the decisions that are done by the major oil suppliers, if they restrict supply, and if that is combined with your exchange rate, which is depreciating, then it gives us a heavily negative blow on our costs. And so going forward, if other things don't let up, like your increase in farm feed, then it ends up putting pressure on the profitability or the viability of a farm business to grow. So those are the things I really cannot predict, because of the things that can happen in the global space as well that can influence, you know, what decisions are made in terms of investments that can influence particularly exchange rate and then eventually. So it's difficult to predict even next month what is the exchange rate going to be, which has a serious impact on your fuel. So it's just a case of occasionally doing models to do forecasts and kind of predicting, but that still does not guarantee, because there's other politics and things at play that influence this thing. So, Chair, I hope that I tried to cover most of the issues. The mention that you made on, you know, the fact that land expropriation without compensation not reason for low growth, indeed I agree, it is not reason for locals, but the environment, as viable as it is, you know, it lagged the investment on physical infrastructure, which sustains long-term growth, is a bit withheld because of, you know, farmers want to see what is happening. So that's just my take on that. Maybe industry might have a different explanation, but that's just my assessment of the environment as it is.
Thank you very much. Any follow-up questions? Honorable Spain.
Chairperson, my follow-up would just be on that slide of 2007-08. I know about the economic crisis worldwide. My question would be, is looking at that slide, it keeps on rising. So there must be other factors. It can't just be the 2007-08 is a massive one, we can see that. But if you look before 2007, it was a slight, like, almost increase. So there must be factors. How are we going to change that around? Because we can't, the increase can't just go up. That's what's going to happen. People are not going to invest, and then we're going to sit with a massive crisis.
Mm-hmm. My colleagues.
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to add in responding to what the Honourable is following up on. I just want to remind the House that, you know, agriculture is a dual economy for status, and most of the analysis will lean more towards your commercial sector because those are the stats that we have. But following up on, you know, on the question that the Honourable has asked, remember, we are moving from a sector that was protected and it was also subsidized heavily, given that slow-moving trend. From 2004 to 2006-2007, we were slowly moving in from that state into a free market where farmers can decide, they can diversify how they should sell, which market to pitch to. And that has got a lot of dynamic in terms of how they will respond. You know, you see them, you know, diversing into various streams of agriculture and, you know, with the hope of making their business more profitable. Therefore, you will see the escalating debt, given that farmers, or if you're a farmer and you've been producing and you've been receiving support, now you have to maintain your own production. So your maintenance cost, there is no way that they will go low, given that you want to have a profitable business.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kappa.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, you will pardon me on this one because I would really want to come out of this meeting having been convinced otherwise, because I'm still convinced that this petrol issue, to me, it definitely has to affect the productivity because the farmers have to use diesel in any, but there's transportation, there's mechanization, and I'm convinced it definitely affects the productivity, but that's why I'm saying I would like to ask from this meeting that I'm convinced that it is not the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable, this graph already, as it is, it shows you in terms of your estimate of cost to a farmer, what each input cost share is in the cost of running a farm. So fuel is there, yes, but it's not at a level that is high as such, though it should be watched because there's dependencies on what influences it. As I was mentioning, the exchange rate is the biggest issue here. But it
it is costing the farmer, like it would cost a consumer to drive with their car every day, but its contribution into the farming business, you know, it's not as high as other things. I just wanted to mention that, though we cannot say we undermine its influence, and because its influence is dependent on other external factors like your exchange rate and what the oil suppliers in the global space are deciding to do. If they withhold supply, it will increase the price of oil, but also if that is coupled with an exchange rate that is depreciating, then it adds more. So the only thing I could say, if we had our own oil production initiatives in the country, then we would talk about things like biofuel, you know, using some of our produce, your sorghums and things, to produce biofuel so that we make it easy for farmers to have lower fuel costs. Then we will talk about such things. But then those are things that are open for us to make decisions about. Thank you.
Honorable Sir, Chair, I think Dr. Maja hoped that I will not get back. I used the opportunity because one of the slides spoke about the decrease in the ostrich industry. So while Dr. Maja is here, can I ask the question on where we are with the avian influenza and opening up the ostrich industry for export? It was one of the slides, Chair.
Okay, if Dr. Maja has got an answer, you can respond. But if you don't have an answer, you can say, I don't have an answer, I can then bring the answer when in the next time. Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, honorable members. I was hoping
the honorable Sir is worried that you have not spoken.
I can see that. except I'm still going to say a few words on the poultry testing that relate to DAF. But honorable Chairperson, the outbreak of avian influenza has fortunately subsided. We have not reported any cases in poultry, in chickens, in over 6 months now, except the recent case in a poultry house in Gauteng in March, April of this year. Unfortunately, outbreaks in the ostrich industry are still open. We haven't been able to close most of those cases with the OIE. So as a result, we cannot declare end of outbreak and declare the country free. However, I'm made to understand that exports of feathers and skins were not severely affected because those go into feather processing, and the markets that accept those products are not as sensitive as the markets that accept the meat when it comes to avian influenza. They were affected, but not as badly or as severely as the meat was affected. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. A lot of the state is very happy that you have spoken. thank you very much, honorable members and the team from department. Unfortunately, we have to suspend this one item of the task team because of the DTI's request. So we'll get some time to get the feedback on it. So that was the end of the agenda. And thank you very much for coming. The meeting is closed. Thank you very much.